and powdered cocaine. I did the heroin and got completely anesthetized and passed out in my bed, the bed that I'd always been sober in up until that point. Now my house was full of that dark energy, especially the bathroom, which was trashed. When I woke up, my first thought was, please God, tell me this was a nightmare. I figured there was a 2% chance that it hadn't happened. I was holding on to that, saying, come on, 2%, tell me that was a dream, tell me none of that happened. I got up, and I was shaky, and I peeked into the bathroom, and it hit me. How did that happen? That was not in my script. Now the guy who was going to live and die sober had fucked up the track record. I didn't know what to do. I was dumbfounded. Now that the beast within had awoken, it wasn't done. Part of me wanted to go with it, but part of me was so ashamed about having done that to myself that I cleaned up the mess and pretended it hadn't happened. But I felt empty and hollow, like I was made out of styrofoam. All my strength was gone, and my brain felt empty. Looking back, it would have been an opportunity to go straight to somebody and say, this is what happened, let me start day one, right now. I should have gotten rid of the secret and gotten some help, but I couldn't do that. I certainly didn't tell anyone in the band. We were still feeling our way, rehearsing and trying to write new material. One of the ways we bonded was by each buying a new Harley Davidson. We even started a mock motorcycle gang that we called the Sensitives. Now that we were coming off a huge hit and we had a supportive record company that was prepared to spend money, we decided that a change of scenery might help in the creative process. Chad and I took a reconnaissance mission to Hawaii and found a beautiful farm on the south side of the Big Island. It was on acres and acres of land and complete with white horses in a corral. The main house had a nice kitchen and a big living room to rehearse in. There were two or three guest houses scattered across the property, along with a pool and a tennis court, all of this overlooking the magnificent Pacific Ocean and about a 3-minute ride to some of the best snorkeling in all of Hawaii. We rented it for a month and shipped our motorcycles out. Extravagant stuff for guys who'd been living in small apartment buildings a couple of years previous. The problem was, the spot was so beautiful, it was difficult to start playing music, because we just wanted to swim in the ocean and have luxurious lunches and find some cliffs to jump off of. Finally, we started jamming. It was a slower, different flow than we'd ever had before. Good sounds were being created, but there wasn't any effortless telepathic transmission happening, where we were all instantly in one river going in one direction. I think I must have been lost in my own mental space, because I didn't go in there with an unquestioning sense of confidence. I wasn't sure what to make of the new sound that we were creating. I didn't know exactly how I fit into it. But I was willing to keep putting one foot in front of the other and keep on with my weird, bizarre style of writing, which seemed interesting to me, even though I wasn't getting much feedback from anybody else. Some very nice things did get planted during those rehearsals, things that would later turn into songs. Flea wanted to reassert himself as a force in the creation of our sound and the direction of our songs, which was fine, because he'd always been an essential contributor. But I think he felt it was now his turn to dominate in that respect, and it was different. I could tell that Dave was perplexed by our methods. He was looking around, going, is this how it's supposed to unfold? Anthony goes over there and writes in a corner all day while we jam? Are we getting anywhere? Chad and I were like, yeah, that's how we do it. In retrospect, there was pressure because we were following up such a massive hit album. I don't think it was conscious pressure where we talked about it. Okay, it's time to do better than we did last. It was more low-grade, subconscious pressure, a sense that we were under a microscope, that there was a built-in number of people who were looking at what we were doing. We had removed ourselves from mainland America, which gave a further bizarre flavor to everything. While we were there, I would write lyrics for hours every day. But sometimes there were periods when new music would accumulate and I wouldn't have any ideas for all of it. To get a change of atmosphere, I'd get on my motorcycle, drive to a corner of the island, find a bed and breakfast, and hole up with my tapes and write lyrics. I remember coming back once and Chad saying out of nowhere, "What's the matter? Are you having writer's block?" I had to educate him that there was no such thing as writer's block, that writers write when they write, and when they don't, they don't. But he was convinced that I had it, and he actually gave an interview to Rolling Stone in which he told the guy that the sessions were going well, except I had writer's block. That was a bone of contention for a while, coming from him, of all people. Back at the ranch, we'd work in the morning. Then we'd go snorkeling and have lunch. We'd work for a few more hours and usually spend our nights playing poker and screw your neighbor. It was fun to sit outside, drinking beverages, after a long day of playing and writing, and just joke and shoot the shit and play cards. When we got ambitious, we'd take a day off and explore some of the places I'd found on my outings. We went scuba diving and volcano hiking, everywhere, on our four choppers. All this time in Hawaii, I'd talk on the phone to Jamie for hours every night. After a month of work, our lease ran out in the house and everyone went home for a week. But I stayed in Hawaii, and Jamie came out to visit. I picked her up and brought her back to the house, where we spent a very nice first night together. We had an arrangement. I was to do no ejaculating of any kind in her absence. No masturbation, no wet dreams, no other girls. I had to save every last ounce of my chi. Jamie was quite a sexual young girl, and she needed repeat performances, so she didn't want me having a shortage of juice. After that, we rented a treehouse in the magnificent Waipio Valley, which was an enormous Garden of Eden. Then we spent a few days in Maui before it was time to reconvene the band and work again. When we came back, we rented an old tropical mansion on the north side of the Big Island, which was a vastly different environment. It was a large bed and breakfast, and we rented the entire place for a month. By then, we had about half the album written. We worked but played, too, taking two scuba diving trips, including one where we saw an amazing school of melonhead whales pass right by us. One day, we were working and got a call from Lindy, who informed us that Kurt Cobain had killed himself. The news sucked the air out of the entire house. I didn't feel like I felt when Hillel died. It was more like, Jesus Christ, the world just suffered a great loss. Kurt's death was unexpected, because even if I see somebody who's on a mission to hurt himself, I always hold out hope that he can recover. Some of the worst junkies I've ever known in my life have gotten sober. It was an emotional blow, and we all felt it. I don't know why everyone on Earth felt so close to that guy. He was beloved and endearing and inoffensive in some weird way. For all of his screaming and all of his darkness, he was just lovable. So his death hit us hard, and it changed our whole experience out there. It did wake up a thing inside of me that wanted to express my love for him in a particular way, without having it be an obvious ode to. That day, I retreated to a back house on the property and started writing the lyrics to Tearjerker. Tearjerker. My mouth fell open, hoping that the truth would not be true, refused the news. I'm feeling sick now. What the fuck am I supposed to do? Just lose and lose. The first time I saw you, you were sitting backstage in a dress, a perfect mess. You never knew this, but I wanted badly for you to requite my love. Left on the floor, leaving your body. When highs are the lows and lows are the way, so hard to stay. Guess now you know, I love you so. I liked your whiskers, and I liked the dimple in your chin, your pale blue eyes. You painted pictures, because the one who hurts can give so much. You gave me such. We finished the rough outlines for probably 10 songs in Hawaii. Now it was time to go back and finish the lyrics and begin work with Rick Rubin in the studio. Then I got derailed again. Somebody had given me a coffee table book about drug use in the New York projects. The book was rife with incredible tales of drug street life and resplendent with amazing photos depicting that world. I was sitting at home alone one night, and that book was on the coffee table looking at me. So I picked it up and started reading it, and a light bulb went off in my head, and the little horns came out. I checked my pockets to see how much money I had, and I checked my schedule to see if I was free for the next few days. I realized it had been a few months since my last slip, and I could get away with this. My intention was always to go out just for the night and sleep it off, and then I'd go back to being a normal guy. The drive downtown is an experience unto itself. You're controlled by this dark energy that's about to take you to a place where you know you don't belong at this stage in your life. You get on the 101 freeway, and it's night, and it's cool outside. It's a pretty drive, and your heart is racing, your blood is flowing through your veins, and it's kind of dangerous, because the people dealing are cutthroat, and there are cops everywhere. It's not your neck of the woods anymore. Now you're coming from a nice house in the hills, driving a convertible Camaro. So you get off at Alvarado and make the right. Now your senses go into this hyper-alert radar situation. Your mission is to buy these drugs, and you don't want anything interfering with that. It's like being in a battle where your life is going to depend on seeing everything around you, the guy in the corner, the undercover cops, the black and whites. You don't want to commit any obvious traffic infractions, so you signal and make your left onto 3rd Street, cognizant the whole time of any cars behind you. Then you go 2 blocks, and you're passing Mexican families, and a couple of motels, and a corner store, and there's a grocery store on your left, which was the scene of many incidents in your life with Jennifer when you used to shoot up in the car and start throwing up out the window. All these memories are flooding back at you, and the minute you make the right onto Bonnie Brea, half a block up on the left, you see groupings of dealers. They're incredibly aggressive, and they watch every car that comes around the corner to see if it's a car there to buy stuff. You either pull straight up on Bonnie Brea, or you make a left onto the next side street, and they come swamping down upon you. They're in your passenger window, they're in your back window, and you have to choose which madman you're going to buy from. The dealers are used to people buying $20 worth, or $40, or maybe $60, but you pull out a wad of hundreds and tell them you want $500 worth. They can't even keep $500 worth of crack in their mouths, which is where they store it, just like the balloons of heroin, under their tongues. So they start hustling and pooling their resources and come to you with a handful of saliva-covered crack. You make the deal, and then you ask these guys, "Who's got the Chiva?" And they point. Chiva is the dope. Then you go to another block and buy 3, 4, or 5 balloons, the whole while trying to make it happen quick because the cops could be there any second. By now you know where to get pipes, and you're buying the little Brillo pads to use as screens in the pipe, all the techniques that you've picked up from the street dealers. Then you go home and get high. As soon as you hit the pipe, boom, there's that familiar instantaneous release of serotonin in the brain, a feeling that's almost too good. You instantly start short-circuiting in your brain, because to get all that serotonin at once is so crazy and so intense that you're liable to stand up, take off your clothes, and go walking into the neighbor's house because you feel that good. And on one occasion, I almost did do that. I came back to my beautiful, sweet, blessing from God home, up against this park, and I walked into the kitchen and took that first hit. And it's always about the first hit. The other hits are all in vain, trying to recapture that first one. And I stuffed as much rock as I could in the pipe, and as much smoke as I could in my lungs, and I held it for as long as possible, and then I released the smoke, and all that manic, psychotic energy came swirling around me again, and I instantly became a different person. I was no longer in control of this person. I threw off my shirt, and it made perfect sense to go next door to my neighbor's house with half of my clothes off and see what was going on. I knocked on the door, and she came out, and I said something like, "Did I leave my keys in there?" And she said, "No, I don't think so, but let's have a look." I was ready to take off the rest of my clothes and see how things went, because I wasn't in control of my faculties. She was kind and sweet, and fortunately I didn't make too much of a scene. 3 minutes later, that feeling evaporated, and I realized I was over there half-naked, looking for keys that didn't exist, so I mumbled an apology and went back home and hit the pipe again. Absolute madness. I'd been struck with a couple of bolts of relapse lightning, and my thinking wasn't that great. I was carrying around this secret inside of me, and it was poisoning my entire thought process. I was pretending that everything was A-okay, but the integrity of my entire psychic structure was starting to collapse. I had a few more songs to write lyrics for, and when you're in that state of mind, it seems like a good idea to change your geography. The problem, obviously, was the town I was living in. So I decided to go to New York, which was always an inspiring town for me. Plus, Jamie was there. She had made many a sojourn to L.A. to visit me, so I decided to return the favor. My plan was to check into the Chelsea Hotel and write for a month. The Chelsea was an artist compound, full of freaks and old-timers and misfits and drag queens and dope fiends and jilted harlots. It was a land of 1,000 character ghosts. For the same price as a 4-star hotel room, I was able to get a beautiful penthouse with a full kitchen and an incredible view looking south. I moved in, but I wasn't feeling right inside my own skin. Here I have this wonderful space in which to write. I've got great tapes to work with, I've got tons of notes and ideas, my girl's a 10-minute cab ride away, I've got the city in my view, but I feel fucked up inside. I set up my workspace, and I went to work and wrote a little bit and ate a little bit, and Jamie came over and we watched movies. But I didn't feel like myself, which is a horrible feeling. I was edgy and Ugh, in that limbo of not being on a run and not being sober. One night, a week after I'd checked in, Jamie must have been off doing her own thing, and I was home alone, and it was nighttime, and this overwhelming notion came over me to go down to Washington Square Park and see what the action was with the drug dealers. I jumped in a cab, went down there, and started talking to some of the local scallywags. I scored a handful of rocks and couldn't find any dope, so on the way back, I bought a couple of bottles of red wine, thinking that would take the edge off the coke. I smoked a crack, and it wasn't even getting me high, but one more time, I was on this ride. I wasn't digging it. I started hammering the wine back, and I just wasn't well. I was like a clock that had exploded. My springs were hanging out, my hands were cockeyed, and my numbers were falling off. Jamie showed up, so I hid the wine and told her some cockamamie line of excuses that I must have eaten something bad. In the end, we had an argument, because I was out of my mind. That was the color of my experience during that whole month. I'd get it together for a few days, but it basically disintegrated into an unproductive and sad month, because I wasn't getting much done. I wasn't sober, but I wasn't using in the way that would have given me relief. In July, the band went into the studio to record the album. Even though I wasn't finished writing all the lyrics, we decided to start cutting the basic tracks. By then, I had put down the getting high thing and was white-knuckling the dryness of not using, but I was behind in my work and not well prepared emotionally or physically. I did have some lyrics that I believed in, but I hadn't trained my voice to go in there and be able to do my thing. However, Rick and Chad and Flea and John were all ready to fire away. It's funny. No one suspected that I had slipped from my more than 5 years of sobriety, but if you look closely at the lyrics I was coming up with, there were clues galore. In Warped, I wrote, "My tendency for dependency is offending me. It's upending me. I'm pretending to be strong and free from my dependency. It's warping me." Later, in that same song, "Night craving sends me crawling. Beg for mercy. Does it show? A vacancy that's full of holes. Hold me, please. I'm feeling cold." Even on an upbeat song like Aeroplane, there were lyrics like, "Looking in my own eyes, I can't find the love I want. Somebody better slap me before I start to rust, before I start to decompose." That's a cry for help. Later, "Sitting in my kitchen, I'm turning into dust again. My melancholy baby, the star of Mazzy, must push a voice inside of me. I'm overcoming gravity. It's easy when you're sad to be." Even Deep Kick, which was a historical account of our journeys, referenced this giant gray monster of drug addiction that had enveloped so many of our friends. At that point, John was getting into a sordid drug trip. Bob Forrest, Pete Weiss, and Dickie Rude were all in Never Never Land, and River and Hillel were dead. We laid down the basic tracks, but I was still having trouble with the lyrics. A lot had to do with my state of mind. When you're at odds with yourself, it's hard to create. Sometimes the writing process is as easy as opening up the window and letting in the breeze, and sometimes it's like chiseling away at a block of granite with a pencil. On August 1st, I should have been celebrating my 6th anniversary of sobriety. To the outside world, I was. My dad hadn't acknowledged the first 5 years of my sobriety, but on that would-be 6th anniversary, he sent me a t-shirt that said, 6 years clean. I had to accept it, but it was one more thing to feel horrible about. The band took a break from recording to play the Woodstock Festival. Judging from my love handles in the photos, I'd have to say I stayed sober for at least a month before Woodstock. Woodstock was our first show with Dave, even though he'd been in the band since the previous September. Lindy came to us and said, "Okay, you're headlining Woodstock. Anything special you want to do?" I sketched out a giant light bulb on the floor, and Lindy thought I meant a cartoon light bulb that went off over your head, but I meant light bulbs that would encompass our whole heads. Dave was looking at us going, "I'm gonna be wearing a giant light bulb?" We got a Hollywood prop master in the valley to create the light bulb costumes, and we hired this Russian-Mongolian seamstress to make 5 identical Jimi Hendrix costumes, because our encore was going to be fire. The 5th costume was for Clara, Flea's daughter, who at times became an integral part of our show. The light bulbs were a tough way to initiate Dave into our performing thing, because that wasn't his style. He was more into being cool and sexy and risque, a naked muscle guy, and here we had him dressed up in a silver spaceman suit with an enormous light bulb head. but he didn't complain at all. We didn't know what to expect for our first show with Dave, but we played for more than 200,000 people, and it sounded pretty damn great. The light bulb costumes turned out to be difficult because we didn't rehearse with them and didn't realize that it was impossible to look laterally out of them and see your fingers on your instrument. But they were a striking, sensational look. Now it was time to return home and finish my work and concentrate on my sobriety. Instead, I did the opposite. My house had been tainted, and it was the perfect little isolation castle at the top of the hill. I had a gate down below so no one could get up to the door. I decided it would be a good, bad idea to start getting into the cocaine and heroin zone again. I ended up finding this Mexican billiards place downtown that was a full-service stop. I didn't have to go up to the corners. I didn't have to buy stuff right on the street or go to different guys. I could just go in there and grab a beer. And when they finished their pool game, they'd come by with gumball machine containers filled with rock cocaine and heroin balloons. Occasionally, I'd see somebody I didn't want to see, some young white males from Hollywood who might recognize me. But I had taken to pulling my hair up under a baseball cap and wearing glasses, and that was a pretty good disguise. Then I'd hop onto my motorcycle and drive to a deserted, derelict area of downtown. I'd take out my pipe, pack it full of rock, and smoke it, and it would be like a steam engine exploding in my head. My eyes would fall out of my head, my heart would start racing, and there'd be this ringing in my ears. Then I'd fire up the bike and kick that thing into high gear and take off like a rocket for home. I'd come home and close the front gate, lock the front door, and turn off the phone. I had two or three places in the house that I would spend my high time in. One of those was the kitchen, which is where all the implements of destruction were. But I'd end up on the third floor of the house. I had this weird old 50s couch, a television, and a boombox on the floor. I'd go up there and drag along my art supplies, drawing pads, glitter, markers and pencils by the gazillion, inks and other weird objects that I could cut up and paste around. I'd get into this fixated thing where I'd get high and go to work on these bizarre creations, meticulous and precise drawings of faces and nude women, bizarre bodies and breasts and mouths and eyes, and also scary Japanese demon faces. Days would go by and I'd just sit there, very comfortable because my whole body was acclimated to these chemicals. I'd also get out random art books and books of nude models and lay them all around the house so I could see the images wherever I went. Meanwhile, I'd make the occasional contact with either Lindy or Flea. They'd ask me when they could book the studio so I could do my vocals. My excuse for not working was that I had a weird stomach ailment, something that had to do with my experience in Borneo, so I'd constantly see this stomach doctor and buy more and more time. I was even taking walnut shell medicine that was supposed to rid my body of its parasites. It was such an obvious line of crap, but it worked. Nobody questioned why I wasn't coming to the studio. I kept going deeper and deeper into this world of repetition. Jamie would come to visit, and it wasn't pretty, because I wasn't well and she didn't know what the situation was. The sad thing is, people don't want to believe that the person they're in love with is out of his mind, drinking and using, so if you give them even half an excuse, they're going to want to believe it. A girl with no prior exposure to the disease had to be blissfully unaware of the nefarious tricks of the dope fiend. That's how I was able to get high all late summer and autumn and pretend like it wasn't happening. I was saying, I'm sick. I was deteriorating physically and emotionally. Jamie was tolerant. And it did speak well of her character, because she was not the type to abandon ship during a crisis. She didn't consider backing off or bowing out. She was just there, which I can't say about everybody. I don't know if I could say it even about myself. I began to drop some pretty tantalizing clues. I drove to the studio one day, and Flea came by the car and saw a discarded Cheetos bag on the floor. That would be a huge tip-off, because if I was clean, I would never even think about eating junk food. But Flea wasn't sure it wasn't left over from Jamie, so he never put two and two together. Another time, Jamie was at my house, and we ordered some food delivered. I collared the delivery boy on the front steps and offered to give him $100 tip if he would give me all the cash he had on him. I'd put the tip and extra cash on my credit card. Jamie was eavesdropping on this whole negotiation from the landing at the top of the stairs. There I was, in total conniving whisper mode, trying to do this dirty deal with the delivery guy, who, by the way, did come through for me. Jamie said, "What was that all about?" And I had to be the abominable lying machine. In the middle of October, we played two dates with the Rolling Stones. It was an awkward time because my father was in town to visit, and he was staying at my house. I came home after the first show and made some lame excuse to drive down the hill and came back with a small amount of narcotics. And I wasn't Jimi Hendrix or Janis Joplin. I couldn't go trash myself and turn it into a soul stew on stage. I would trash myself and be half a man with half the joy in my step. But opening for the Rolling Stones is a shite job anyway. I can't recommend it to anybody. You get the offer and you think, historically speaking, they're the second most important rock band in the history of music after the Beatles, so we should have a brush with history. But the fact is, the Rolling Stones audience today is lawyers and doctors and CPAs and contractors and real estate development people. This is a conservative, wealthy group. No one's rocking out. The ticket prices and merchandise costs are astronomical. It's more like, let's go to the Rolling Stones mall and watch them play on the big screen. The whole experience is horrible. First you get there, and they won't let you do a sound check. Then they give you an 80th of the stage. They set apart this tiny area and say, "This is for you. You don't get the lights, and you're not allowed to use our sound system. And oh, by the way, you see that wooden floor? That's Mick imported antique wood flooring from the Brazilian jungle, and that's what he dances on. If you so much as look at it, you won't get paid." You're basically like a little TV set on the stage, playing your show as 85,000 wealthy, bored-out-of-their-minds fans are slowly finding their seats. They're all wearing their Rolling Stones letter jackets and leafing through their catalogs, deciding which Rolling Stones t-shirt and which pair of Rolling Stones slacks they're going to get. We were the music to be played for ushering, seating, snack-getting, and clothes-buying. It was a nightmare. In November, I tried to go back into the studio and do some singing, but I wasn't in any kind of shape to do it. I did a mediocre job. I was skinny and sucked up, bad color, bad skin, scraggly hair, droopy, dead-looking eyes. The cat wasn't out of the bag yet, and everyone thought I was run down from being sick all summer. I was beginning to realize that drug addiction really was a progressive illness, and God forbid, if you should start using again, it would be worse than it was before. When Jamie came to visit, I'd force myself to go without for a few days. Then I'd take her to the airport and head straight downtown. I had a few close calls with the law. One time I was smoking coke in the car and was way too high to drive safely, and I had a bunch of paraphernalia and drugs right under the seat. I must have been driving erratically because a cop pulled me over. I got the window halfway down, and this young, vicious-looking LAPD cop shone his flashlight on me and said, "Oh, Mr. Kiedis, my bad. I'm sorry, sir. Excuse me for the interruption, but I really have to tell you that this is a pretty dangerous area, so you might want to exercise caution around here. You have a good night now." That wasn't quite the reception I was expecting. Another time, I'd purchased both of my products and peeled away, cutting through traffic, and a black and white pulled me over. I had stashed the coke under an ashtray, but I had the balloons of heroin right in my hand. I didn't want to get busted, so I quickly swallowed the three balloons, which weren't digestible, so I wasn't in any danger. When the cop came over and asked me why I was in that neighborhood, I made up some story about visiting a girl, and that mollified him, so he didn't search the car. Then I had to backtrack and buy some more heroin. That was the beginning of what would be a marathon binge. 4 days later, I wound up finishing everything, and it was daytime, and I was beat down and delirious. I'd spent all my cash, and the last thing in the world I felt like doing was driving downtown in the daytime heat and interacting with drug dealers. I was on my way into a liquor store to buy some paraphernalia, but I was so full of toxins that I had to casually stroll over and vomit into the gutter. As I vomited, I looked down and spotted those three intact balloons full of heroin. Yeah, free drugs! I hit the jackpot, I thought, and fished out the balloons and saved myself a trip downtown. Jamie came to visit in December, and by then I had an ugly heroin habit. I'd been smoking both crack and heroin for a couple of months straight. This was in anticipation of our Christmas trips home. We had decided over the phone that we would give our dads big cars. Jamie was on a roll with her modeling, and she wanted to give her pop a pickup truck, and I wanted to give Blackie a Bronco. By then he had moved back to Michigan. Right after we did so well with Blood Sugar, I'd visited him, and he was living in a tiny apartment in downtown Grand Rapids. I had an epiphany that I had just made a ton of money touring, so I should buy him a house. We found a nice house on a lake in Rockford, out in the country, and Pops was taken care of. Jamie and I arranged for the truck to be shipped out to Pennsylvania. Our plan was to drive Blackie's brand new, luxurious, spacious Bronco to Michigan. After the two holiday celebrations, Jamie and I would go to the Caribbean together, to a resort on Caneal Bay on the island of St. John. She still didn't know what the hell was going on with me, but since my clothes were hanging off my emaciated frame, she could see that I was sick. I was like, "Oh, we're gonna go away for Christmas. I'll get healthy. We'll go to the Caribbean. Everything's gonna get better from here on out." Unbeknownst to her, my foolish notion was that I'd buy a bunch of coke and a bunch of heroin and wean myself as we went across the country. This is never a good idea. But I'd convinced myself that the farther away from LA I got, the fewer drugs I'd do. I had to make a number of sojourns downtown, during which I bought out every dealer I encountered. Jamie still had some last-minute Christmas shopping to do. By now, I was taking a hit off the pipe every 10 minutes, wherever I was, in a phone booth, a bathroom, behind a tree, wherever. Once I got high, I wasn't acting all spooked out, because I was so accustomed to it. So we started packing and gathering goods, and she was gleeful about this imminent departure for a cross-country trip, and I was going along with the glee, but really, I was Spirograph brain. I drove her to pick up some slippers at a fancy shoe store in Melrose, and as soon as she left the Bronco, I fired up the old pipester. I was sitting there smoking like a fiendish monkey when all of a sudden I heard a sharp rap on the window. It was Jamie. She had caught me red-handed. The whole masquerade that I'd been holding up was over. I was mortified, and she was shocked. She popped me the finger and tried to run off, but I grabbed her and talked her into coming back into the car. I went through the psychedelic Rolodex of what page works for this problem. I had no choice but to tell her what had happened and how I'd ended up here and what I was prepared to do about it, as long as I didn't have to stop getting high at that moment. We drove to Waddles Park, and I put it all on her, the whole sordid story. I told her that I loved her from the bottom of my heart, that I'd do anything for her, and this was a serious fucking problem that I'd been through before, and there was no easy solution. I told her my plan to drive across the country and wean myself off the cocaine and heroin, so by the time I got to Michigan, I'd be clean. It was a temporary solution to an enormous and life-threatening problem, like putting a Band-Aid onto a severed jugular. She was not having it. "Fuck you. Fuck you, you motherfucker. Where's my plane ticket? I'm going home. You're an asshole. You're a liar. You're a scumbag. Yeah, I'm all that stuff, but I still think you should stay. I've got my stuff, and by the time we get to Michigan, I'll be donezo," I said. Jamie told me that she'd had suspicions all along, and that she had been telling my mom and Flea that maybe I was doing drugs again. Of all the dreadful, self-deprecating, self-loathing, isolated, fucked-up feelings that you get as a drug user, one of the worst is having your girlfriend conspire with your best friends and your family on your behalf. It's the ultimate in humiliation, knowing that your best friend and your girlfriend are talking about you behind your back because you're using. Then your family's in on it, and you feel pathetic. You know they feel bad for you and want to help you, and it's just like, "Ah, stay away. Don't even bother. I don't need your help. I don't want your help. Don't even talk to each other, please." Finally, she agreed to take the trip with me. I don't think she realized how disconcerting it would be for her to be in a car with me getting loaded every 10 minutes until the stuff ran out. We left California and got to the desert, and I was having to make all these stops, not sure if I should be getting high in front of her or if I should hide it. I was getting more comfortable with the idea of her watching me get loaded, but it was still not my favorite thing in the world, because the physical act of ingesting the drugs is so ghoulish. We kept driving and driving, and at one point, I was too high to drive, so she took the wheel. We were listening to Nirvana Unplugged and Mazzy Star, and she was crying her eyes out. Then it was nighttime, and we were in the mountains of Arizona. The road was slick and icy and dangerous, and out of nowhere, what looked like a gigantic super elk, bigger than the whole car, leapt across the road. Jamie swerved to avoid it, and we were fine, but I looked at the road sign and realized that the town was where my grandmother had driven off the road to her death. I took it as an omen, as if the spirit of that elk was saying to me, "Wake up, motherfucker, because you're dying." That wasn't the first time I'd experienced interactions with spirits while I was doing drugs. One time during this era of relapsing, I came back to my house in the middle of the night, pockets full of drugs, ready to be the mad scientist. I was fiddling through my pockets to get my keys out when I heard this crazy scream. I figured it was somebody I knew who was on the balcony screaming at me like a crazy witch, but I didn't see anybody. I stepped back from the house and said, "Hello? Anybody there?" Again, I heard that horrifying scream. I looked up on the gable above my bedroom and saw a giant hawk sitting there, staring right down at me, screaming his lungs out in this tortured human voice. I thought that this guy did not want me to do what I was doing, and if I didn't stop it, I would probably die. This would happen periodically, once a month or so. There'd be a bird, sometimes an owl, screaming at me at the top of its lungs when I came home on these furious misadventures of drug use. When you're using drugs, you're driven by this mystical black energy, a force inside you that just won't quit. And the weaker you get, the more you feed into that energy, and the more it fucks with you. When your spirit becomes dark and your lifestyle becomes dark, your existence is susceptible to infiltration by dark spirits. I've seen it so many times with addicts. You can see that they're controlled by dark energy. The way they look, their appearance, their voice, their behavior, it's not them. I remember when Hillel died and I was just getting clean, I had a dream lying in my bed next to Ione. It was one of those horribly vivid, half-awake, half-asleep dreams. All of this terrifying energy came flying into my bedroom along the top of my ceiling. They were demons and goblins and ghouls and creatures, a full assortment platter of scary motherfuckers. I could tell that they were coming to fuck with me, to say, "Okay, we did our job on your friend, now we've come for you." At first, I was like, "I'm not having it, you guys. You came to the wrong house." As I was putting up this psychic fight, the granddaddy of all dark forces, this vast dark angel, came flying in and encompassed the entire ceiling of my room. But I wasn't open to them. "No, no, no. Be gone. Bye-bye." That was the beginning of my getting clean. I noted the message from the elk, and we drove on and found a motel. I kept getting high in the room, and Jamie was beside herself. A lot of her pain and suffering were coming to the surface. She took a bath and locked herself in the bathroom and stayed in there for 3 hours. I was getting loaded and doing an art project with reflective letters I'd bought at some truck stop and periodically knocking on the door saying, "Jamie, you all right?" After a while, I started to worry. When she finally opened the door, I saw that she had taken a razor blade and carved an A into her arm. That whole episode was scary, and even though I was loaded, I was starting to come to grips with the fact that I had created a lot of pain and suffering around me, not just within me. The next day, we got up and drove into Flagstaff. Neither of us had really slept. I kept getting high. Jamie was sad and pissed off and confused and tortured by all of this, so I went into a Native American arts and crafts jewelry store and bought a couple of matching rings. In my mind, it was a promise to get better and be together ring. I think she may have taken it as an engagement ring, but I was desperate and lost and grasping for straws. Deep down inside, I loved this girl a lot, and I wanted nothing other than to be with her, but I couldn't stop using. We got back into the car and drove to the end of New Mexico and checked into a motel. I was down to my last balloon of heroin, and we'd been gone only 2 days. The coke had long since run out, but I was more concerned about having enough heroin to get through the next few days. Still, I announced, "This is it. This is the last time I'm going to be getting high." She was so sick of the whole drama. I got every last grain of that stuff into my body and didn't even get high. I tried to sleep that night, and the next day I woke to the fucking hell that is heroin withdrawal. I was shaking and feverish, and we still had a long way to go. Jamie became the one and only driver, a tiny, beautiful, blonde princess behind the wheel of this huge truck. I pushed the seat back, got on the floor, crawled inside a sleeping bag, drank a whole bottle of NyQuil, and went into a raging dope kick, sweating and shaking and fainting just out of it. And Jamie kept driving. She drove for hours and hours and hours while I was in this fever inside of this sleeping bag. She drove straight through to Michigan. Once again, I was home for the holidays with a raging heroin habit. Chapter 12. Over the Wall. It was hard to hide my drug problem when I got to my mom's house. For one, I looked like a walking skeleton. Besides, Jamie had already voiced her suspicions about my drug use to my mom, who then had talked to my dad.
"Anthony was having stomach problems when I got out there for the Stone Show in October," Blackie told my mom. "He had to go out in the middle of the night and get Pepto-Bismol."
"Hello? What are you talking about?" Peggy said. "He's using." Blackie always seemed to be in denial about my drug use. It was probably too painful for him to deal with, so he carried on as if everything was okay. Now the cat was out of the bag. I settled into the comfort of being home. I knew I had to start going to meetings and eating lots and lots of food. I was okay with the idea of not getting high, but again, I didn't recognize how serious my problem was. The measures I was taking to deal with it were light in the loafers. It's a good start to go to a meeting and get the truth on the table, but it's another thing to think that that's going to work. You have to go back in full force and work the 12 steps and do the whole 9 yards. You can't just show up and be a spectator and expect to receive recovery through osmosis. I was dabbling. But we had a lovely Christmas. I tricked out my mom's house with a hot tub. My sister Julie had started dating a guy named Steve Simmons, and we were all so happy that she'd met a guy who dug her and treated her well that we spoiled them with lavish gifts. Especially when you're coming off a long drug run and you've been distant from your family, you feel obligated to make up for it with deluxe material goods. Jamie was even able to relax a bit. The shock and horror started to subside, and I wasn't getting high, so I got a little bit of my sex drive back, and things got more joyful. She began to look ahead to a brighter future for us. When our relationship was working, it was tons of fun because we were best friends, and we laughed about everything. Jamie had a way of diffusing my seriousness and was a great companion. How wonderful was it to be in love with a sexy, sweet girl who also loved basketball? On Christmas Eve, we drove the Bronco over to Blackie's. I had arranged for a giant ribbon to be placed over this rocking truck. Blackie answered the door, grumbling that we were late, and I told him to come out and see his present. He was befuddled, so I threw the keys in his hand and he got nervous. Then he stepped down the path from his front door to the driveway, and he saw that perfect Michigan winter car, and my poor dad seized up. He looked at the car, and he looked at the keys, and said,
"No, no, that can't be,"
trying to hold back the tears. It was really touching. Christmas morning belonged to Mom. It was her time of the year. The whole house was done up in Christmas fashion. She had the old-school stockings hanging above the fireplace, with a stocking for Jamie, of course. There was a classic golden retriever, and the snow was falling outside, and my sister, Jenny, the baby angel of the family, was into all of it. It was a magical time. I came down at 7:30 in the morning and started the fire. Under that towering tree, there were more presents than should be allowed by law. The first thing we did was go for the stockings, which had 20 individually wrapped gifts from my mother, things she had amassed all year long. Then we opened the presents. My job was to deliver them, and people were getting jewelry and fine suits and sweaters and electronic stuff and blah, blah, blah. Steve Simmons had walked into an idyllic situation because the love and generosity were flowing. The dog had a ribbon around his head. The fire was blazing. Various delectable foodstuffs were constantly coming out of the oven. Johnny Mathis and Frank Sinatra and Bing Crosby were on the stereo. So this crazy guy, Steve, who was a new love of my sister's life, stopped everything and said, "I just wanted to take a minute and say that this has been the best Christmas of my life. You've all been incredibly generous and given me so much." We were thinking, yeah, he's right. I guess we really have lavish stuff on this guy. And he continued, "But I'm not quite done asking you for something." The room got silent. Jeez, what more does this guy want? He said, "I'm gonna have to take this moment to ask for your daughter and sister's hand in marriage." He reached over to Julie and said, "Julie, with the support of this family in this room, will you marry me?" Everyone started crying. I couldn't believe this guy was busting this incredible proposal right there in front of the whole family. It was the ultimate capper to the morning, and Julie accepted. After a few days, it was time to fly to Pennsylvania. Jamie was thrilled to give her dad the F-150 truck, which was a badge of honor in his community. Jamie's parents were liberal enough to let us sleep in her old bedroom, with them down the hall.
I felt so awkward about having sex with her in that house. She was a go-getter fire plug, and she'd rip off my clothes and throw me down in the bed, and I'd be whispering, "I can hear them in the kitchen. We can't make too much noise." She didn't care. She just wanted to be loved. From Pennsylvania, we flew down to the Caribbean for some R&R. I had called my travel agent and asked her for the most pristine spot on the islands. It was an exorbitant amount of money per week, but with everything that I'd been through the past 6 months, I didn't care. I wanted to go to the warmest, most beautiful, most relaxing place I could find. Lying in the sun and swimming and eating and exploring and having sex were my idea of getting healthy. And it worked. We had a little house right on the beach, with no television or telephone to distract us, just hundreds of acres of tropical paradise. I needed that. Even after a week of gorging myself on lobsters and grilled fish and gobs of dessert, and being Mr. Exercise Guy, my clothes were still falling off me. But eventually I got my strength back. Now it was time to go face the music back in L.A. It was difficult coming face to face with Flea again, but I'd much rather see him knowing that I changed the direction of my compass towards sobriety than to run into him when I'm loaded or when the compass is stuck on stupid. When push came to shove, Flea was incredibly supportive of me. I came back with some shame and embarrassment and regret for having disappointed the whole operation, but we'd been through it so many times that it had become customary. Flea is the type of friend who can be off doing his own thing, but when the shit hits the fan, he'll be there for me. At moments like this, he's non-judgmental and accepting of the chaos. I don't feel like, oh shit, now I gotta go get an earful, this guy's gonna condemn me. He's like, dude, I'm really sorry you had to go through that. I'm glad that you're alive, and let's go party. Meaning, let's go write music. Dave stayed sober through all my troubles. He understood the mechanics of alcoholism, so he was incredibly supportive. He was probably hurting over the experience and bumming out on it, but he never once subjected me to any negativity because of my behavior. It was uncanny how loving and forgiving and tolerant they were all willing to be. Now that I was back on my feet, our first priority was finishing the album. So we booked the studio for the end of January, and right before that, Flea and I took a trip to Taos, New Mexico, to write and play music and figure out the rest of the album. We rented an authentic adobe villa, and I holed up in my bedroom and wrote. Then Flea would take out his acoustic bass or a guitar, and we'd work on the song together. We were there only 4 or 5 days, but each day we finished a new song. Flea had stepped up to the plate in my absence, even contributing lyrics to the album. He wrote the bulk of the lyrics to Transcending, which was his tribute to River. P was his attempt at flying his humble flag, but he also wrote the intro to Deep Kick and the vocal melodies to the verses for My Friends and Tearjerker. He was supplying me with a lot more information than I'd been used to receiving, but I was open to it, and it was a necessity because I'd been so disengaged from the creative process. Taos was productive and fun. We even went up to the mountain one day and skied through a blizzard. There's a peculiar thing that happens every time you get clean. You go through this sensation of rebirth. There's something intoxicating about the process of the comeback, and that becomes an element in the whole cycle of addiction. Once you've beaten yourself down with cocaine and heroin, and you manage to stop and walk out of the muck, you begin to get your mind and body strong and reconnect with your spirit. The oppressive feeling of being a slave to the drugs is still in your mind, so by comparison, you feel phenomenal. You're happy to be alive, smelling the air and seeing the beauty around you and being able to fuck again. You have a choice of what to do. So you experience this jolt of joy that you're not where you came from, and that in and of itself is a tricky thing to stop doing. Somewhere in the back of your mind, you know that every time you get clean, you'll have this great new feeling. Cut to a year later, when you've forgotten how bad it was and you don't have that pink cloud sensation of being newly sober. When I look back, I see why these vicious cycles can develop in someone who's been sober for a long time and then relapses and doesn't want to stay out there using, doesn't want to die, but isn't taking the full measures to get well again. There's a concept in recovery that says, half measures avail us nothing. When you have a disease, you can't take half the process of getting well and think you're going to get half well. You do half the process of getting well, you're not going to get well at all, and you'll go back to where you came from. Without a thorough transformation, you're the same guy, and the same guy does the same shit. I kept half measuring it, thinking I was going to at least get something out of this deal, and I kept getting nothing out of it. We went back in the studio, and by the end of February, I had knocked out my vocals. We'd gone from getting nothing done for months to shazam finishing the vocals. After I completed my last vocal, I was so jazzed about being done that I thought, you might have to get high. It was the same celebratory cognition that I'd had with Hillel after Uplift Mofo. I was a fucking broken tape. I had to rush into the bathroom at the recording studio right after this idea, because the thought of going downtown and copying was making my bowels churn in anticipation of getting high. Then I said goodbye, told everyone I'd see them in a week or so, and bolted for the darkness of downtown to start up the unstoppable chain of madness one more time. Unfortunately, Jamie was coming to visit me in a few days. When she arrived at LAX, I was AWOL. She had to go right from the airport to a modeling job and kept calling me from the job, saying, "Where are you?" It takes away a lot of the thrill of killing yourself when people are looking for you and you're disappointing them, because it is a lot of fun when you're out there killing yourself. You're escaping from the cops. You're avoiding getting stabbed to death by dealers. You're running the risk of overdose. You're having escapades of delusion. It's exciting. But when it becomes, oh shit, someone's looking for me, it puts a damper on the insanity party. I hid out in a motel. This was the beginning of the great motel tour. I didn't check into the Peninsula or the Four Seasons, places that I could have easily afforded. No, I opted for the Viking Motel, or the Swashbucklers Inn, shitty, torn-up, dirty-ass dope-fiend motels that were for poor families who had no place else to go, or for prostitutes, dealers, pimps, hoodlums, and other scandalous motherfuckers, and a bunch of white drug addicts who were sneaking away from their real lives. I started checking into these places up and down Alvarado Street, because they were a few blocks away from where I bought my drugs. Maybe that's part of the thrill. You can make your score and then drive three blocks, check right in, and you're smack in the middle of this circle of hell. If you're in a reputable hotel, chances are that you'll run into somebody you know. When Jamie was looking for me, my motel sophistication hadn't evolved that far yet. I had made it only to the Holiday Inn in Hollywood. That was where she and Dave Navarro tracked me down. Dave had the smarts to call up Bo, our accountant, and ask her where my last credit card transaction had occurred. She called the company and told Dave that I was at the Holiday Inn. I was in there trying to sleep off the heroin and escape from myself and this latest mess I'd made when I awoke to a crazy knock on the door. I went to the peephole and looked out and saw Dave, and then Jamie, lurking in the back of the hallway. It was that bad combination, your loved one and your friend conspiring together. "Come on, dude, open the door," Dave said. "I love you, and I want to help you get better. This isn't happening. Let's go to rehab right now. Throw away your junk and let's go." I wouldn't open the door. "No, you don't understand," I called out. "I feel really bad. I need to sleep. I'll call you later and we'll go tonight." Nope, I got the car outside," Dave said. "I've already called Exodus. They've got a bed waiting for you. Open the door." I opened the door. At that point, I couldn't fight or argue anymore. I had fucked up, and the only way I had to appease these people who were unhappy with my behavior was to acquiesce and go back to rehab. So I went. By April 1995, the world of rehab had evolved into a much different animal than my first stay in 1988. Going to rehab had become commonplace. Among rehabs, Exodus was famous for two reasons. It was a place that Kurt Cobain had left right before he died. Kurt had climbed a 4-foot fence to escape when all he had to do was walk out the front door. They can't keep you in Exodus against your will, but I guess if you don't want to see anybody on your way out, you bolt. Exodus was also famed for the renowned doctor of rehabology who ran the place. Guys like him claimed to know how drugs affect the body, but to me, all that information amounted to nothing. As long as a dope fiend is high, he's crazy. The minute he isn't high and he starts working the program, he'll start to get better. It's the simplest plan on earth, but they try to complicate it with psychiatric jargon and detoxology. Just get a junkie off the streets, get him three squares, and get him working on his steps, and he'll get better. I've seen it in thousands of drug addicts I've come across who attempted to get well. It doesn't matter how wonderful their detox or therapist was. Exodus was off the beaten path in a larger hospital in Marina del Rey. It wasn't connected to the prison system, so there were no end-of-the-liners who chose rehab over prison. It was plusher than a Section 36 facility, but not as much so as Promises, a Malibu rehab that makes the Four Seasons look like the Holiday Inn. But again, the place doesn't make the difference. You're either going to do the work and figure out your problems, or you're not. You don't need promises. You can get better at the Salvation Army on Skid Row. I've seen people get well in both, and I've seen them not get well in both. Being there that time was actually a beautiful experience. I made 10 of the most atypical friends I'd ever make in my life. There was a weird old lady from some town up north, a Brazilian doctor, and a pillhead from Texas. My first roommate was a gay kid from the heartland of America, Kentucky or Missouri or someplace. He had the classic story, young, misunderstood kid grows up in a football town in the Midwest, doesn't get the whole macho deal that his whole world is revolving around, so he's alienated, isolated, and ostracized by his family. He moves to Hollywood, finds his gay brethren in the drug and alcohol world, and hits the downward spiral. He was so into Vicodin that he'd crush them up and sprinkle them on his cereal for breakfast. He left, and my next roommate was a black anesthesiologist from Inglewood who came from a highly respectable family. Made his family proud by becoming a doctor, but then it turned out that he'd been abusing all the best medical drugs he could find for years. So he came in, like the rest of us, for 30 days. You could tell that he was keeping secrets and destroyed that he had let his family down. A couple months after the rehab, I got a call. He had relapsed and couldn't bear the agony and shame of facing his family, so he locked himself in a closet at the hospital where he worked and chose the most unpleasant drugs to overdose on. A few of us from Exodus went to his funeral, and it was really emotional. He had a big family, and one of his brothers was a preacher. There was a holy roller vibe at the service, and everyone was crying their eyes out, including his rehab buddies who were all in the back row. There was an uncommon array of people in there with me, and I became friends with all of them. You recognize the possibility of your own demise in the lives of these other people. You're doing the same thing they are, but you can't see it in yourself. However, you start seeing all of these tragedies and potential miracles in other people. It's a real eye and heart-opening situation. Here you are in a fucking hospital in Marina del Rey, sleeping in a small bed, sharing your room, and having to go to the cafeteria for your breakfast. You're forced to think, where did I go wrong? I had a plan and was doing really well. But now I'm in here with a bunch of other crazy people, and nurses and doctors and wardens are telling me where to go and what to do, and I've got to report to a group. Wow, thought I was smarter than this. At some point during my stay, I had a group meeting with friends and family, and Flea showed up. During the circle, the drug counselor turned to Flea and said, "Okay, Flea, tell us how it makes you feel deep inside when Anthony's out there using drugs, and you have no idea where he is or if he's ever going to come back." I was waiting for Flea to say, "Ah, pisses me off, that motherfucker. We were supposed to be rehearsing and writing. I was waiting for 12 hours, and that bastard never showed up. I'm ready to do something else altogether." Instead, Flea started sobbing, which caught me off guard. He said, "I'm afraid he's going to die on me. I don't want him to die. But I've kept thinking for years that he's going to die." I had no idea that was the way he felt. I began a practice at Exodus that is a major part of my life to this day. During the 5.5 years that I'd been sober, I never got into prayer or meditation. I wasn't clear on what it was to cultivate a conscious contact with a power greater than myself. At Exodus, someone who worked there suggested that I start each morning with a prayer. Now, to anyone in recovery, that's Get Well 101. That's where you begin your program. I had never thought that it was what I had to do. But one morning, I looked in the mirror and thought, "You're throwing your life away here, so maybe you're going to have to try something that's not your idea, but an idea from someone who's actually doing well in life." I started praying every morning. Once I opened my mind to the concept of a greater power, I never struggled with it. Everywhere I went, I felt and saw the existence of a creative intelligence in this universe, of a loving power larger than myself in nature, in people, everywhere. My prayers and meditations would gain steam and momentum over the years and become an important part of my recovery and daily experience. I got through the 30-day stay without even thinking about leaving. I accepted that I was there to do the work and get back on track. For the first few days, they give you a whole plethora of meds to detox on. You get chloral hydrate, which would put an elephant to sleep. They give you Darfacets and Klonidin patches to lower your blood pressure. When you see a guy shuffling down the hallway in his robe and slippers, that's the dude who's still on detox. The first few days off medication are rough. Your skin is crawling, and you're coming to grips with not being on anything. But then you pull out of it and start to feel better. They feed you all day long, and you get to exercise, and you go to meetings.